Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started. I often tell my therapy students when we talk about trauma that all therapists are trauma therapists because it's really almost impossible to go through life without experiencing some type of trauma. And obviously, some of those traumas are more severe than others. And it's kind of a tough transition from hearing Sean McDowell speak about the kind of the cultural context to this conversation. But I think it's so vital, partially because trauma language is in the popular vernacular now. And so it's not unusual for a teen that's in your youth ministry to talk about PTSD or to talk about trauma. And sometimes you might be sitting there going, well, is this actual trauma or is this trauma that, you know, they just kind of made up the word for? And so this morning, Holly Morris, who is a licensed marriage and family therapist and specializes in working with clients who struggle with anxiety, depression, and life stage transitions, but particularly with PTSD and complex trauma. Holly is like my go-to person for a trauma client that I don't know what to do with. And they always send them to Holly, and they always come back just telling me how important the work that she does with them has been. She's the founder of Heart and Arrow Therapy and has offices in Los Alamitos and Tustin. Holly used to work with SIFT years ago. Did I hire you? Oh, wow. Yeah, that's even better. But she's just a wonderful, warm human. And a delight to, really just a delight to know. So come on up, Holly.
Hi. Nice to see you all out there. Thank you, Kevin, for that warm introduction. And yeah, this transition does feel a little funny, going from all of that energy to now let's talk about trauma. But when I was given kind of the topic to talk about with trauma, and I thought about being with all of you today, I really utilized kind of a subtitle for our time together today, which you can see it up there. But really want to lean into the empathic piece of relating with people, well, all people, right? But specifically thinking about people that have been through really difficult things. So what I'm hoping that we'll see together is that experiencing traumatic or even stressful things is part of being human. And then there's a continuum of how intensely is this actually impacting the individual person that might be sitting in front of us or having a conversation with us. And so it'd be helpful for me to know in the room now, how many of you are working with like high schoolers? Oh, a lot of you. Okay. And what about beyond high school? And how many are in training or are therapists? Okay, perfect. Thank you. It's good. We have a full room with lots of different things going on here. So, am I moving? Oh, there we go. Okay, so here's the start of our framework together today. And so you'll see that there is a bridge of empathy. And we can kind of springboard off of some of what Sean was saying earlier today when he was saying it really is about relationship. And so there's so much that's going to seem so practical or it's something that we know, but just kind of how does this translate really into a person who's sitting in front of us who's experiencing a lot of pain or has experienced something that feels like it's kind of thrown an X into their O world? And so we're kind of going to be looking at, yes, there are stressful events that can cause grief and sometimes cause trauma. And then also this bridge of empathy. So there's a definition there that we'll work off of that's from the dictionary, but the ability to understand. So we're going to be leaning into the understanding. I wish I had better eyesight. There's this really great slide back there, but I just can't read it from this far away. I should have brought my glasses. And sharing the feelings of another. And so if any of you are familiar with Brené Brown, she is an excellent researcher and storyteller about belonging and about shame and about empathy. And you'll see the quote there. And it's just about the fact that there really isn't any script. There's no perfect way to do this. But what we can do is really lean in with a lot of care and curiosity, and that can communicate so much to someone right in front of us. And there's also another quote there about shame. So when we think about the concept of shame, shame really shields any sort of resource or any sort of connection. And so if we're able to, again, be able to lean in such a way that somebody that we just really want to understand us, to accept us, to care enough, can be there empathically for us, then that can open up a whole world of things that we can begin to understand about us and our experiences. So we'll move on to the next slide, because this is part of our, Shauna, Oh, back one, please. So we're just going to pull from, and I'm not going to read the scripture in total here, but there's a few of them behind me, and we'll just kind of lean into some of the encouragement of Paul. When we think about what we really wish for people that we work with, what we wish for ourselves, is that we would be confident in the security of Christ, right? I mean, he goes on to say all the specific things, but that would be our wish for ourselves and others. And then when it comes to things that can disrupt our formation or disrupt the way we think and feel about things, the way that we might interact with others, then also this reminder that we are all part of one body and that we're all given unique talents and gifts to give. And sometimes when trauma happens and disrupts the way that we're able to be, can also disrupt the continuing development of some of the ways that we are uniquely gifted and talented. And so this just holding in this framework, that part of being able to be empathic and having people be able to live more openly and authentically is also putting us closer in contact with who God has designed us to be uniquely. So when I was creating this slide, this is a lot of what we'll be with today. And I was looking at it and I thought, wow, this looks like January. So I think that this is probably something that we can all relate to. Here's the human piece. So I'm just going to describe to you some of what we're looking at. And at first I kind of wanted to layer it and I thought, nope, we're just going to look at the whole thing together because this is exactly what it's like when stress and trauma hit. So you'll notice that there's kind of this lightning bolt and it says that there's an event, right? And we're going to go into all of these things in much more detail about, you know, what type of an event. But when there's, we'll just say that there's a stressful event. Sometimes if it's a traumatic event, it may be referred to as a trigger. But there's something that comes up, the event, boom. So this middle area here, it's almost like if you could see it like it's a road. That's referred to as the resiliency zone in the trauma resiliency model. So that's what this image is pulled from. And so we're kind of just going along, and you'll see that there's kind of just a wave there. And we'll just consider that these bounds here, like this road, sometimes you might hear it referred to as like the window of tolerance. But we'll say that this is kind of just your road, and you're just, it's the okay zone. You're resilient. You're present. You're able to respond to things. And then right outside of that road, up on the top, is the hyperarousal. So you'll see that there are qualities listed there, but it can include anxiety and anger in those pieces. Then on the bottom level, it's feeling low or tired or sluggish or dissociative. And so this is the majority of a part of our days. And so I wonder, just with a show of hands, like if we were looking at the very middle as a baseline, and I'll have you just consider this for one moment, like this morning, up until this point, I'm going to ask just for a raising of hands of like who would say that they found themselves a little bit above baseline? And who, oh, okay, yeah, let's go for it. Who would say they found themselves above baseline? And who would say they might have found themselves below baseline? Like, it is a rainy day. I just want to stay and cuddle up and maybe not go to a little talk on trauma. So before we go to the next slide, I'm just going to invite you guys to do a little exercise with me. And so if you're comfortable, I'll have you even close your eyes. If not, maybe just finding a place to focus so that you won't be distracted by anything else. And what I'll encourage you to bring to mind is a time that someone listened well to you. So that might be somebody who listens well often. or it might be something that came up just recently. But as you're able to bring this person to mind, I'm just going to encourage you to notice what you see. Not even necessarily what you're hearing. But what is it that you're seeing with this person who's listening well to you? Maybe just noticing one thing. And I'll go ahead and just encourage you when you're ready to go ahead and open your eyes. Sometimes that might be a really nice moment you're not ready to move away from. But you can go ahead to the next slide, Shauna. So I just want to reflect for a moment. Sometimes when we're talking about things that are deeply, deeply hurtful and the potential of hearing that from someone else or going through it ourselves, it can be kind of confusing and it can be stressful. And so just in that moment, I'm imagining that you all saw some of these qualities in this person who was listening to you. And I mean, if we pull up, you know, articles or something online, it's ranging usually anywhere from 50 to like 85% of our communication is nonverbal. And so even just knowing that sitting and being able to sit with someone goes a long way. So just as a reminder of these things and the things that you probably already do very well. So we'll just kind of start with that, and then we can go ahead, Shauna, please. So, well, you know, similar to some of what Sean was saying, when I thought about, ourselves, but especially young people, I just almost wanted to say social media, period. Because social media, you know, it started with Google, now it's all of the social media. It's so easy to find an answer. It's so easy to find an influencer that says, oh, I relate to this, this, and this. I always say, like, mostly TikTok, but I would say TikTok's like the other therapist in the room a lot of times. So I saw this, and I think they're just like me. I think that I have this certain diagnosis, right? But sometimes also it can be really, really helpful. So when somebody is going along and watching a reel and they see something like this, they can see, okay, so I don't know that I have PTSD, but I can definitely see that these are all signs and symptoms of post-traumatic stress. And is this maybe some of what's happening for me? So really being able to utilize social media to benefit sometimes is really helpful. So we're going to talk first about the event. So this partially comes from the DSM, which is our statistical manual. And it partially comes from something called havening techniques, something that I'm trained in. But we'll look at what are really the components of saying this thing is beyond a stressful event. It may actually be traumatic. So the event itself has to be perceived as being life-threatening. And by life-threatening, that might not mean your actual, like, breathing being, but it could mean also the loss of some kind of major attachment. And so as you kind of are seeing that on the flip side over there, to the right, that it would be some kind of attachment. And sometimes we don't think about attachments as being relationships or reputation, but that can also sometimes cause a traumatic response. And then we also consider the landscape. So in havening techniques, we're really looking at more of the biochemical landscape of the brain because of the approach of processing. But this could also be looked at as, what is the landscape of life at the moment? One family with six kids that their only car gets totaled is going to be a much more traumatic incident than somebody who has a spare, right? So just kind of looking at, like, what is the landscape? And then there's at least a perceived thought of inescapability. So we're going to talk about the fight, flight, freeze response. But in order for it to be traumatic, our statistical manual says you have to at least feel like you couldn't get out. Somehow you had to endure it. And when we're looking at things like childhood abuse, there's quite a bit of that because of the place that they're at in development. We'll touch on that later. But it can be even from that, right? Someone else holds the power to somebody is physically holding me down, right? So we're going to look first at this fight, flight, freeze response. You'll notice there that there's also submit and cry for help. Sometimes that's referred to as fawn. But what we're looking at is our system, when it becomes activated in some way, we want to orient to that. And we're wanting to be able to respond. So in a minute, we'll kind of talk about what the brain does. But with our fight, our body is ready to fight, to flee, if those two things do not work, or sometimes fawn, which would be just being able to talk yourself out of a situation, then we would go to freeze. And freeze really is the depletion of a belief that anything more can be done. So the system is shutting down. So when we're talking about trauma, oftentimes what has happened is the system is doing what it's designed to do, but something gets in the way from it being able to be completed. And so then we see the development of things like triggers, because the body is trying to complete this action that was held arrested in this traumatic experience. And so when we talk about trauma too, you know, there are a lot of thoughts that go with trauma. There can be a lot of identity assignments that can come out of trauma. But trauma mostly is something that is a feeling. And by a feeling, I mean it's an emotion, and it's also a feeling in the body. And so I pulled this artwork. It's there on the screen where I got it. But, you know, people get hooked up to different types of machines, and they look at what does this emotion look like in bodies, and they collect, you know, most for the most part, it's all of this. And we can see how this is such a human experience, isn't it? It's like for the most part, we feel fear, joy, anxiety in very, very similar ways. And somebody who hasn't experienced trauma may have a lower grade of emotion, and all of a sudden, they're very emotional. Or you might notice that someone has a lot of emotion, and then they experience something that alters their life, and their emotion goes much, much lower. So with thinking about how trauma lives in our bodies, regulation strategies are really, really important. Because when you think about it, I like to think about like a crying baby, right? So if a crying baby is so upset, it doesn't matter how healthy the food is, the baby can't take it in, right? And so here there's listed some regulation strategies that can be utilized. But the first that I have there is a box breath. And so sometimes it can seem kind of cliche to think about taking a deep breath. It's on, like, you know, signs on the wall, just breathe, right? But when we're looking back at the system that becomes dysregulated, that the brain believes I need to do something to survive here, taking a deep breath is a signal to our biology that we are not needing to fight a tiger, right? That light that's coming toward us is not the oncoming train, it's a flashlight. So when we take that deep breath, it starts to help our bodies move into more of a place of regulation. The box breath is just some, there's lots and lots of ways to do deep breathing, but the box breath is just basically imagining the four sides of a box. And it's a four count inhale, holding for four, a four count exhale, and then a four count wait. So it's just kind of a simple way to remember. It's the way that I teach my clients, because four times of four is much easier to remember than other things, even though there are a lot of really great apps out there and things that can help as well. But also broadening the landscape. So if you start to notice that when someone's sharing something with you that they start to become distressed, opening up the landscape is really, really helpful. So even in this room, we have walls around us, right? And if someone is starting to feel triggered or distressed, even being able to get outside, right? It's a change of temperature, but it's also a change of landscape. So being able to open it up and to see that you're not boxed in at this moment, you are able to escape. Things like brain games and things that just distract you are really helpful. Moving your body and orienting to time and place. But the language of the amygdala, and when we were talking about fight, flight, freeze, when that starts to become activated, really it's sensory language and experiences that help to regulate it. And so again, I'm just going to invite you to participate, if you'd like to, in an exercise that we'll do next. And so let's just go ahead to the next slide, Shauna. And so just imagining this picture. And so if you will, this is another thing that you can do to regulate your system. Imagine that you are here. You are in this space. And so the five represents our five senses. And so if you were dysregulated at some time, this could even be when you're waiting in line at the grocery store and you are in a hurry and somebody else is taking too long, whatever it is, and you don't want to be stressed because you're moving into something that you want to feel a little more calm for, you can look around and see. And so each of you, maybe you could just notice, what are five things that you see in the picture? So our sense of sight. And then next, what are four things that if you could imagine touching, that if you touch them, they could have some kind of a texture or a smoothness or a temperature? What are three things that you imagine you might be able to hear there? And what are two things that you may be able to smell? And one thing you may be able to taste? And just knowing that this is something we can carry in our back pocket, we can utilize it anytime. If we notice that image of January comes up and we are way off the charts because we are not regulated, this is one thing that we can do. Okay, let's go ahead, Shauna. So one of the key traits of trauma that is very difficult is that when our system is overloaded and cannot handle what is in front of us, there's the freeze response, but also there's dissociation. So usually we'll think about this in two categories, which is depersonalization, like feeling outside of your body, or derealization, like I'm not really here right now. So one thing about dissociation that I hope we can all understand is that, again, it's part of being human. So people will talk about highway hypnosis. And so it's kind of like, you know your way home so well that you're not even thinking about your drive. And so it's a form of dissociation, but it's a mild form, and it's not going to cause any trouble. And all the way to dissociative identity disorder, where there's been trauma that has been so horrendous that the body actually compartmentalizes experiences, and those experiences get halted in time and sometimes can take on even their own personalities and persons. And so, and then everything kind of in between of different types of dissociation. And so let's go ahead, Shauna. So going back to our fight, flight, freeze, this is something that that we can look at too in terms of, is this just a stressful event? Is this something that was traumatizing but didn't cause traumatization? Is this kind of like the first little bit after something very stressful happens and the mind has not even been able to encode that memory quite yet? And so the body is just doing what it needs to do to try to work out something that was an X in the O world. Or did the body take that in and then being in the present moment is becoming something that is intolerable? And so I really like how Janina Fisher breaks this down by the survival stances, because I think that it's really helpful too sometimes to notice for somebody who tried to fight versus someone who tried to run away, there's different types of symptoms that we might see that come up. Because with trauma, what we believe that we know and what we can sometimes see is that the body is working hard to work it out. And so sometimes there might be ways that people might subconsciously or unconsciously put themselves in situations where they're trying to work out that trauma over and over. And for an outsider, it could look really confusing. Like this person grew up in a family where there was domestic violence, and yet this partner that is being chosen is also unkind or abusive. But there may be a subconscious drive to work out that trauma by having a different outcome, trying to master something that went so wrong in younger life. And so looking into each of these categories, it can be helpful to see. And two, when we're doing ministry or we're doing care with people, noticing how severe is this impacting someone? Like, is it a startle response that's lasted a few weeks? Or is this something where someone is now beginning to decrease their world to not be triggered by something? Like a person who has a car accident, and at first they say, well, I'm just not driving freeways for a while. And then it's been a month and it's not the freeway. And then it's been 2 months and it's just back and forth to best friend's house, driving the kids here and there. That's really when we notice that somebody's going to need some extra help to work through that in their bodies. So another lens that we can look at this through is there's always this question about, so why is it that sometimes two people can experience the exact same thing, and yet one person seems to be really impacted by it, and someone else seems to be doing quite okay? And so we're going to look just at these five different categories of areas that can be risks or resiliency. And so where we're going to start is with attachment. And so probably many people in the room have heard of attachment theory. And we're not going to get into a lot of details about it, but everybody comes from a system. Everybody comes from a family. Persons within the same family may not always have the same attachment style, but there's usually some rules in a family that kind of govern behavior and may foster something that looks much more like a secure attachment or an insecure attachment, like anxious or ambivalent. Or sometimes if home is a really scary place or kind of a really absent place, then people might develop something that's called a disorganized attachment. So for purpose of just kind of considering this, we can go to the next slide, Shauna. Here's just some explanations of, and if you're interested, anybody is welcome to take a picture of the slide, but why someone might develop a different type of attachment. But for purposes of just kind of considering a risk or resiliency factor, if someone grows up in a family and they are more securely attached, usually there's a belief that there's enough. So if I went through something so horrible and I need more support, support is available. And it's okay to look for it. It's okay to ask for it. I trust that other people are going to manage themselves well if they need to include other people, what have you. Anxiously attached typically have some distance from emotion. And so when you imagine if there's a family that says, like, hey, we are the Joneses and we pick ourselves up by our bootstraps, and then all of a sudden here is this situation that happens and here is this youth that's having a really difficult time and needing to process emotion, then it may be really difficult to even trust that that could be okay. And then with ambivalent, usually at home, there are people who are available and unavailable. And so it's kind of just trying to find the trick of how do I know when the right time is to ask because somebody's there? And then if I ask at the wrong time, they're really not there. And sometimes they're shaming about it. So there can be a lot of ambivalence about is it okay, is it not okay? And then with disorganized, typically caretaker is somebody who is not available, sometimes very severely depressed or dissociated, or sometimes abusive and scary. And so it's almost thinking about how this youth doesn't live there. Right? Like going home is not a warm feeling. It's a scary place where there's always a sense of awareness of what's coming next. And so really, I put this slide up here just so that you guys could notice in your relationships with your youth, with your friends, with your clients, you are already doing so many things that promote security. The great thing about attachment is that attachment is not fixed. There's earned attachment, there are corrective experiences that can help move that needle towards more security throughout the duration of our life. I mean, we've learned since, I think, the 90s about the neuroplasticity of our brains even, that it's like we used to think that it was pretty set, but now we know that we can really build new neural pathways, which can be corrective experiences that people are having with you. And so when you think about these lists that you see here in columns, you know, it's something sometimes as simple as we have our youth group and we meet every Wednesday. And so for that person who's experiencing something at home or experiencing something in their relationship, that's something that's predictable. It's consistent. And then imagine that they see you there and you have a nickname for them. And so they're known. They're unique. They're welcomed, right? And then soothed. You know, maybe sometimes that just looks like, oh, I always know that Sarah greets me with a hug. And so when I get to youth group, I'm gonna look for her and get my hug because I know that I need that today. But I really wanted to list these things just to encourage you in that you're already doing so much. And maybe there are things that you could consider, wow, I do that already pretty naturally, but I think it'd be helpful to do a little bit more of that. Because maybe this can be corrective for someone. Developmental stage is a huge part when we're thinking about youth. So a lot of times, you know, Kevin was saying that there's a large percentage of people who are going to experience trauma before the age of 18. So when people are coming to you, they may be telling you that something just happened, or they may be coming to you and talking to you about the fact that there was something that happened a long time ago, but it's actually becoming relevant to me now. And so when they're talking about something that's becoming relevant now and in the moment that they're telling you, there are things to consider about what is their age and stage, how mature are they, what types of experiences have they had, because when we're talking about a child living in a household that is mostly run by mom and dad, there's very little agency. There's very little ability to choose. right? Versus somebody who is maybe older, college age, something like that, who maybe could have some more agency in that. And the other thing that I wanted to mention here is that the you know, age under 18, of course, but a lot of times even our youth have siblings who are also younger. And, you know, my clients know that I have the honor and responsibility of being a mandated reporter. And so what that looks like is that I'm the eyes and ears of the county, of the state that holds my license. And so I am having a fixed ear also listening for, is there anything that's leading me to believe or suspect that there's abuse to any child, anyone under the age of 18? And I can't tell you the number of clients who have ruptures because they have gone to someone and said, I have a secret, can I tell you? You won't tell anyone. And so being really cautious about secrecy versus privacy, that's how I tend to think about it. And so secrecy is something that we cannot promise, especially when someone is saying, I want to tell you something, can you keep it a secret? We have no idea what it is that they're going to say. And a lot of us in this room are mandated reporters. But what we can say is, anything that you share with me, I will keep private. You are not going to hear me talking about this with anyone else on staff unnecessarily. You're not going to see it in a prayer list that's going to go around. This is going to be kept between you and I, with the exception of if your safety or the safety of someone else is a consideration. And what I can also tell you about that is that we would only include people to help keep you and someone else safe. So there's that temptation of being trusted to say yes, yes, yes. But just remembering that we can't always say yes and mean it, and our authenticity is so hugely important. The other thing is our support system. So kind of like we talked about with attachment, every student, every youth is coming in with a different support system at home. And sometimes what might happen is something happens to the youth, something happens to a parent, it's impacting the youth. But the support system at home is not really designed to be able to support the care that the student needs. And so really there's a question there that is, are the needs of this hurting person and the support systems that exist, are they aligned or misaligned? And so, you know, I think about, you know, a couple of clients throughout time where they have been raised in families with a certain amount of loudness, or big gestures, or loud laughter, or heat. And all of a sudden, they're having a major startle response. And they're now not fitting in with exactly how the family has always gone. And so when you look at a family that is secure, there's going to be a leaning into that and some curiosity about, hey, I see you pulling back. I see you upset, right? What's happening here? And there may be some that feel intolerable of that. Like, how long is it going to be before you're back with us, right? And so just noticing, that's just one example. But another example, too, is that our church systems, our church culture is representing a system very similar to the family. And there are things about the way that our church services go that are actually very intentional in the right ways. But for somebody who has been abused or groomed, or has had a history of church abuse or had a trouble with authority, I just want you to consider for a moment the fact that we come in and most church services start with worship. Worship is wonderful. It opens us up to God. It also opens us up to each other. It also is a posturing of the heart that puts us in a position of being more vulnerable. Vulnerable to receiving, vulnerable to connecting. All of those pieces. And so for somebody who has been groomed for abuse, and there was an intentional grooming to lead to something that was created them abuse or vulnerability, there may be somebody who you notice all of a sudden can't handle that part of the church service. And so empathically, we're able to lean in and say, you know, what is it that could be helpful here? You know, I think for a long time, or maybe in general culture, we would say kind of like, wow, what is wrong with you? Like, why can't you do things like the rest of us? Then they're opened up to be a question about what happened to you, some curiosity. And from a strength-based approach, we could say, what's right with you? Like, you are noticing that this time is not helpful for you. And so you're making some space here. So how can I support you in that? So just being able to lean into also knowing that we all have an inner knowing of what we may need and want, and so we can lean into that as well. The other thing is, this is from the landscape of that kind of first slide here, but we all have life stressors. And so I don't know if any of you are familiar with the Heart and Brain comic, but that's where that is from. And it's really funny if you haven't ever checked it out, but there's other organs that come along every once in a while as well. But you know, heart is usually chasing a butterfly and brain is usually trying to bring him back to earth. But my gosh, I bet that all of us could relate to this cartoon at one point or another. That it's just, it feels kind of piled on. And then it just seems like, oh, wow, my shoe broke when I was putting it on this morning. And why am I a heap on the floor, right? And we can all probably relate to that. But when we're thinking about a particular student and what they might need from us, it can be helpful, too, to think about these categories of different areas of life and being able to see how one individual person might be responding differently from someone else and raising that empathic awareness that even though these might be two similar situations, this one might need more from us than this one, and these are some things that we can consider. And the last piece is the meaning-making. And this piece I want to really spend a little bit more time on because usually when something horrible happens, so there's a family that looks like everything is going really, really well, and then all of a sudden mom and dad announce that there's going to be a divorce, there may not be really a conscious awareness for someone to make sense of that. They may not have people around them that have gone through that. They may not know how to apply. So kind of thinking about our developmental stage here, sometimes it's not just about age, but it might just also be about who we're around. And so these questions, kind of like Sean was saying, like being able to lean in with questions can be really, really helpful because, you know, joining someone and trying to create some security might look like a story that looks like, hey, you know what, I remember when my parents got divorced. And I remember it was really difficult to even begin to understand how I never knew that they were having a problem. And even that can kind of open up some more questions or some relatability there. But also, there might be that youth has not had anyone around them who has been through divorce. So that might also lead to some isolation and some questions about, how do I belong here? So being able to really pose some curiosity about how is this event or events really impacting how you're seeing yourself, how you're seeing God, how you're seeing the world around you can be really beneficial. And the last piece here that I'll say is that there are incredible advocates among us that have become advocates because of things that they have experienced. And at the time that they experienced it, wasn't the time to think about how in the world am I going to use this to benefit somebody else. But yet through a process of healing and what we refer to as post-traumatic growth, sometimes people might find a passion and a purpose that they never even thought possible or never even crossed their minds until they went through something that threw them off completely for a time. But being surrounded by a support system that could really see them, having knowledge of what happens when someone goes through something like this to help normalize it for them, and then a shorter period of time. But oftentimes they can find their way through the path to seeing that actually their gifts, talents, abilities, the peace that they are in the body of Christ, the increased confidence that they have in all of the security that God and others have to offer, that they can really be an advocate for somebody else who maybe is going through something very similar and needs some help or huge education. That's a lot of advocacy that I also see. And so I do want to read this last quote. And I just love when science so Bessel van der Kolk is probably still our leading traumatologist. And this quote reminds me so much of the way that the church holds one another in prayer that I just put this quote here for you guys to also see and hear. So social support is not the same as merely being in the presence of others. The critical issue is reciprocity, being truly heard and seen by people around us and feeling that we are held in someone else's heart and mind. And so just knowing, too, that as you are practicing that reciprocity with all of these people that you love, that you're being that social support that the leading traumatologist would say, this is exactly actually what we need. So the resources here are things that have been referenced throughout the talk. A couple of things that I want to highlight. One of them is the iChill app. So that slide that we saw that was kind of all over the place, I said it was the trauma resiliency model. The iChill app, it's free. And it's wonderful because it has that chart on it, has a lot of explanation, and also it has a radio button for help now. And so those regulation strategies that we were looking at, several of them are there. And when someone is dysregulated, sometimes it can be really hard to even think about what to do. But to pull up an app is something really natural. And so to just say, okay, help me now, what can I do? And then it directs you. Okay, go for a walk, do some deep breaths, do something to help. And then the other thing that I wanted to highlight was Dr. Kate Truitt. I didn't go into it a lot on the in my presentation to you guys, but I mentioned havening techniques. And it's another regulation strategy. And I always tell my clients it's kind of intuitive and counterintuitive, but it's something that I encourage you guys to try if you're interested at all. So the intuitive part is that it's a touch to the body in a way that is soothing. So this is something when you're feeling dysregulated and you need to really calm your system down. The intuitive part is that the first motion is the forehead. And we do that to babies all the time, right? Like trying to soothe them or hush them. The second one is the arms, which are very much like a hug. And then the third one is the hands. And so these regulation strategies, some of them were distractions. And so it's another thing that you can try when you're feeling dysregulated or your kiddos are feeling dysregulated, to just be able to kind of add a really gentle touch to the body, and then that being the intuitive part, and then kind of the counterintuitive part when we're really upset is like, okay, now I'm going to count to 100. Like, that doesn't necessarily make a ton of sense. But what makes sense about it is that we're really wanting to be able to think. And our prefrontal cortex is just not as available whenever we're really distressed. So Dr. Kate Truitt has a YouTube channel, and she has some explanations about havening, and she started new content during COVID and adds quite a bit there. So if you wanted to check that out, that could be a helpful place to be. And then the last one I wanted to mention specifically is The Power of Attachment by Diane Poole Heller. So if I know that most people are familiar with attachment theory, but on her website, there's a place that for free you can take an assessment if you were ever curious about what your attachment style was. So you can take that, and then it'll give you a printout just helping you to understand that attachment style a little bit more, and then also how we tend to relate to others. So that was the last thing that I wanted to highlight there. And so thank you for your participation, and then there's my contact information if that would be helpful for you.
Yeah, thanks, Holly. Appreciate that a lot. And we're going to have some time for Q&A at the end of today. So we're going to have, after a brief break, I'm going to give you a chance to stretch and get something to drink and use the restroom and whatnot. Those of you who don't know, the restroom is back there, out those doors to the left. As you can tell, I'm getting over like this nasty cough thing. So I start to talk every once in a while, it catches. And then Jacqueline York will be joining us. So why don't we take about 8 minutes, and we'll gather back up at 11:10.
Backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm sorry.
Yeah,
Amen.